All right, here we go, 614. Going to be nice today, a little less humidity than normal, and highs around 90 degrees or so. Tropics are quiet for the next 7 to 10 days, so let's thank the good Lord for that. Todd Belt joins us, professor, director of the Political Management Program at George Washington University, to talk about mail-in voting. How you doing, Todd?
Good morning, Tommy. It's great to be with you again. I'm doing well. How are you?
Thank you, Professor. I appreciate you coming on. Tell me what this most recent poll says as it relates to mail-in balloting.
Right. This poll by the Pew Research Center isn't incredibly surprising. There are a lot of things that people really like about mail-in balloting and some things they don't. And if you think about how people cast and then count the vote, how people pick up the ballots and return them, there's a number of different ways different states can do that. And that's where we see some of the changes between what people appreciate and what they don't. And I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that we had COVID in 2020, and a lot of people were forced to vote by mail or had an option to vote by mail when their state hadn't provided it before. And one of the things we know about mail-in voting is that when people do it, they tend to like it and they like to continue it. And with new technologies, you can trace your vote. You can find out where it is in the process and the cycle. But then you have Donald Trump, who has tried to tell people not to use mail-in balloting. He did that in 2016. In 2020, he changed his tune and he said, bank your vote. He said, make sure you get your ballot in.
Wait, you're not telling me. You're not telling me it was pragmatic. It was whatever suits him best. Is that what you're telling me? Or any political candidate? Is that what you're saying?
Well, it seems like it. And then now he's got this vendetta against mail-in balloting, and it comes after his summit meeting with Vladimir Putin, who told him that a lot of the voting in the United States was tainted with mail-in balloting, and so he's gone full force against it since that meeting. But
well, if there's anybody you can trust when it comes to American voting, it's Putin. Am I right? I mean, just think about how ridiculous. I don't mean to get anybody angry here, but just think about how how ridiculous that is. This guy's what, the president of Russia, been in KGB 50 years, and you're going to listen to what he tells you about American voting and not think that he has an agenda of his own, that he's trying to help you? Really?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It shows you just how strong motivated reasoning is. If you want to believe a certain thing, you're willing to take rather unusual sources to validate your opinion.
So here's my thing. It's like you got to trust something. And there has always been cheating in elections. There will always be cheating in elections. The best you can do is minimize it. You're never going to get it to go all away. And if you want to have all paper ballots, you can do that. But then again, you can stuff the ballot box. That's old school. If you want to have all electronic voting, you can do that. You can, I guess, hack the system and manipulate the numbers. You can do that. If you want to have both, well, then you can stuff the ballot box and manipulate the numbers electronically. I don't know, Professor. Is there any foolproof way?
Well, you can't really stuff the ballot box. I mean, that's one of the things. A lot of the states have restrictions on this. Almost every single state has a restriction or has what's called the paper ballot backup. So if there's anything done with the electronic machines, there's only a couple of counties and a couple of states. And by the way, Louisiana is one of them, where there is no paper ballot backup to be counted from the electronic counter. And when it comes to casting them, the restrictions on being, you know, there are heavy penalties for voter fraud. It is a felony. And of course, you have to sign your name when you return your ballot, and it is matched to the signature on file if that's by mail, and you have to sign when you go into a polling place. And we have seen that, you know, in this poll, we find people are very receptive to even more restrictions on, or at least, you know, ways of making sure people are able to vote legally, particularly the ID law, voter ID. People are very supportive of that. That has been something Republicans have really supported, and the public is behind them on that one. So showing your state-issued ID when you turn in your ballot is something I think that we're going to see a lot more of. The other problem in terms of you're talking about stuffing the ballot is what's called vote harvesting. And this is when a third party goes around and collects ballots. For example, a person who might work for a campaign might go collect ballots from people at a senior citizen's home and then bring them for them to the box where it needs to be submitted. And in one election in 2018, we had some malfeasance with this. It wasn't the candidate, but it was one of the consultants for the candidate, and four of the people that worked for him were going around and trying to collect ballots that they were not allowed to do so, and they caught them. But in reality, cheating in U.S. elections is incredibly rare, and it's incredibly difficult to find an election where it has made a difference in the outcome.
I'm no Todd Belt, but it seems as though if you were to arrest the people and have stiff penalties for vote harvesting, that's the way to make mm-hmm. it go away, not end mail balloting. Yes?
It certainly is. And in fact, since that time, most of the states, there's only a handful of states that still allow some form of some form of vote harvesting. I mean, it's different depending on who you allow to do it. It could be a family member or something like that. Different states have different rules. And that's one of the complicated things about our voting system is our Constitution gives the right to the states to determine their system as they see as it's best for their population. But in this poll, we saw that most people are opposed to any states doing vote harvesting. I anticipate in the coming years, we're going to see more laws against vote harvesting. But like I said, there's still only a handful of states that allow that to happen.
That to me seems the way to answer it. Not drop mail-in balloting, but if you vote harvest, guess what? We catch you, you're going to jail for 25 years. No parole, nothing.
I mean, if you make the penalties, you make the penalties stiff. And, you know, if, like I said, it's usually not the case.
That would make somebody, I think that would make somebody think twice, mm-hmm. Todd, don't you?
Yeah.
How bad do you want your candidate to win? Do you want to spend 25 years in a federal pen? No, I don't think so. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. Todd Belt, our guest, professor and director of the Political Management Program at George Washington University. A lot of people would be disenfranchised without mail-in voting, including folks that are serving in the military, out of state, et cetera, out of the country, et cetera, or even out of state. 621 traffic now, WWL. 626, Tommy Tucker, WWL, having an interesting conversation with Todd Belt, professor and director of the Political Management Program at George Washington University, about a new poll that Americans responded to about voting and mail-in voting, etc. Professor, here in Louisiana, I think we have to show a driver's license when we vote. I believe I do, yeah. And somebody texted and said they're all for that. I am, too. I don't see any problem with that. Are there states that do not require that?
Yes, there are states that don't require that. And in this poll, this was one of the most popular of the measures. 83% of people approve of that. There has been some arguments that it's difficult for some people of lower means to be able to get a voter ID, some older people who don't have them. But for the most part, you know, if you need one to go to the bank, you need to have an ID. So it's not a huge barrier to voting.
You know, somebody texted in, and this is not a bad point. I'm railing against ballot harvesting, but I guess there are people. Well, if there are people in nursing homes, rather than people right. taking their ballots and dropping them off, couldn't they be mailed in, and then you don't have the risk of ballot harvesting? Or even at that point, you don't know who's filling in the ballots for mm-hmm. people at nursing homes. And beyond that, somebody texted in, is it a lot different than, you know, back in the old days? It's been going on forever in America. We load a bus full of people up, you give them lunch, and tell them to vote for this one, right? In a way, I mean, that's ballot harvesting with lunch, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it is technically illegal to offer any sort of incentives for voting, although it's not often prosecuted by the Federal Election Commission, unfortunately. But one of the issues with ballot harvesting that a lot of the activists who do it would argue, and I don't necessarily agree with them, is that when you go to these places, say it's a nursing home, there's a lot of people who would have forgotten to vote, don't realize it's time to vote, or don't have their materials immediately with them. And then, you know, someone can help them make sure they get the materials, then come by and make sure they have the time to do it, and then take care of the process that way. So that's sort of the argument that they make.
But where do you draw the line? Because, again, I'll do respect to everybody in nursing mm-hmm. homes. I'm not trying to mean anybody at mm-hmm. all. There are a lot of active senior citizens that are fully capable and so forth. But even then, how would you enforce that somebody, an orderly or an aide or a doctor, even as a nurse, is not taking a ballot and filling it mm-hmm. in like they want?
Right. There is the only way to really do this is to control where you can turn it in. And, you know, a lot of places have drop boxes and they want to make sure people aren't bringing in more than one ballot at the drop box. That's a way to enforce that or to get rid of the drop boxes altogether, which, of course, would make it much more difficult for other people, meaning that you would have to turn it over to a state official directly. And again, you know, that makes it more difficult for other people. But of course, you can always drop it in the mail, although people have gotten away from using the United States Postal Service in recent years, as we do everything electronically these days.
There are no simple solutions to complex problems. Real quick, Professor, you're in Washington. Mm-hmm. What's the feel there, the vibe with the National Guard all over?
You know, the National Guard has been placed in certain areas around the city, and it's not in other areas around the city. But, you know, there are certain areas like Georgetown, which is not known for being a hotbed of violence or homelessness, where there are a lot of National Guard people there. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of this is a lot of window dressing and a lot of photo ops. I don't know exactly that they've been doing a lot. I haven't seen a big change to where I go to, but, you know, I don't know what's going on in the rest.
I was in Washington in January, walked around for like 6-7 hours from Georgetown to the Capitol, to the Lincoln Memorial, Ellipsis, White House, and back to Georgetown. I never felt unsafe at all. The only thing I can tell you is Pennsylvania Avenue is not straight. There's one point where it, I don't know what happens there. Professor, do you know?
Yeah, well, we've got the White House there, you know, and you can't go through that. And then, of course, there's a couple of...
I think it's going down straight, but then it goes into another street, which is fine until you've been walking for 7 hours. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. Todd Bell, Professor, Director of the Public Management Program at George Washington University. We'll come back, talk about this Cracker Barrel dust up. Right now, it's time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. You know, Ian, I'm going to try to be delicate here. There's nothing that'll quite ruin your day like stepping in dog poop with new shoes, right?
Yeah, I've been there, done that.
Yeah. It'll really, really ruin your day when it's in your own foyer when that happens.
Oh.
Apparently, Grady had some trouble yesterday. I don't crate him because, well, I'm a pretty laid-back parent. I'm not a helicopter parent. I'm a free-range parent, and I can't blame him, though. I think it was probably the wallpaper he ate off of the wall that didn't agree with him.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a rough stretch for Grady. We'll take a break. We come back. We'll talk to Tim Calkins, clinical professor of marketing at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. But I didn't yell at him because he didn't know. You got to catch him in the act, because if you don't catch him in the act, they don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Poor dog, though. He was hungry and he...
No,
wallpaper?
I don't... No, no,
oh, man,
no.
That's a hard
counselor,
lesson.
Counselor, hang on a second. Objection. He had a bowl full of food and a bowl full of water.
And he still went with the wallpaper.
Well, yeah, the wallpaper needs to be changed, so maybe that's what he was trying to say. I don't know. We'll be back to talk about Cracker Barrel logo changing when we return on WWL. I saw this yesterday, 6:44, Tommy Tucker, WWL, and I started to talk about it. I didn't get to it, and I'm kind of glad I didn't, because we have Tim Calkins with us today, our friend, clinical professor of marketing at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. Talk about a couple of different things. We'll start with Cracker Barrel that changed the logo, then got some criticism from it, from including, I think, President Trump, and then went back. How you doing, Professor?
Oh, I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm okay. I don't mean to make this political, but I don't like governments picking winners and losers, and it seems like I don't know what a conservative is anymore. I don't know what a liberal is anymore, because it seems like the conservatives back in the day would say, make your logo whatever you want. Yeah, I don't care. That's your business. Do what you want. Just employ people and pay taxes and move things along. Am I missing something?
Well, it's amazing how even little things like changing a logo can end up as a big political debate. And this one has really touched a lot of nerves. And so it's become a very hot issue. And it's, you know, sort of played right into the political divisions in the country. And
so what they did really is, new. I'm sorry, they removed the old man sitting in the chair, a Revere ladderback chair, it looks like, leaning on a barrel, and instead they reshaped the Cracker Barrel background or whatever it is and changed the font a little and made a Cracker Barrel without the guy in the chair, and it's more of a black ink than brown. Is that accurate?
Well, this is part of a big program they have to try to modernize Cracker Barrel and try to change a little bit the feel of the place. So they're renovating the restaurants, they're changing the menu a little bit, and then they went ahead and changed the logo. And the logo change really set off this for all the controversy. And indeed, they did exactly that. They removed the fellow and the barrel, and they changed the logo to a much simpler version. But people put it all together and said, oh, no, now you're ruining this very special place called Cracker Barrel. And that led to all the controversy.
Okay. Boy, I got to choose my words carefully here. I don't know that it's a very special place other than a chain store with the same stuff in every store you go into and a chain restaurant with the same food everywhere you go. And secondly, I think what people need to realize is instead of going woke, and I had the privilege of working with a guy, Ed Muniz, that taught me for the first time in my life, this is 25 years ago, when you're running a business, you can't think next year or next week, next month, next year. You got to think 5, 10 years or 20 years down the line, right?
Well, that's the sort of the bigger story here. I think what's happened is
But what I'm saying is reason they were trying to upgrade everything is because their customer base is getting older, and they realize, like, to explain, what is it, a pig through a python when it comes to marketing?
Well, I think the underlying problem really is that they've got an aging consumer base, and Cracker Barrel hasn't been doing very well. The revenue's down, the profits are way down, the stock price is down. And so they really have to do something to try to upgrade that business and modernize it and bring in some new people. That's what they're trying to do here. But it really has touched a nerve and annoyed some people.
Have they thought about improving the food? I'm just wondering.
I think they are. Well, they're certainly looking at the menu. They've kept a lot of the classic things you might get there, casseroles and this traditional kind of food. Mm. But they've added some new menu items and sort of this bid to renovate it and sort of upgrade it. But it's been interesting to see how much controversy it sparked.
I'm far too cynical to have you on today. I'm sorry. It just, when I saw this yesterday, it's like, you got to be kidding me. With everything going on in the world, we're worried about Cracker Barrel logo, but it does manifest itself in the stock market and business and everything else. So when it comes to logos, why do people get so attached to logos, and how important are they when it comes to marketing?
Well, what's interesting about logos is that companies will often change their logo fairly frequently. Every few years, many companies will make these little changes to the logo, but they're small changes. You might change the type font. You might change the shape a little bit. It's just trying to make sure the logo is sort of up with the times. And all those little changes, most people don't even notice they're happening. Does the logo matter? I think the logo matters a little bit. It contributes to our perception of the brand. That said, I don't think anybody makes a choice about a restaurant because of the logo. You don't say, oh, where should we go tonight? Oh, let's go to Cracker Barrel. I love that logo. I mean, that's not. I mean, it affects the brand, but it doesn't directly affect sales.
Does Cracker Barrel's business draw upon local people, or is it mostly travelers on the interstate?
Well, I think it's both. A lot of their locations are by highway exits, and so that's going to pick up the traveler crowd. But for frequency, you really want the local people to come on a regular basis. I think that is really what's behind this. They're trying to make it more of a destination where somebody might want to go to on a Thursday night for dinner, something like that, and that's what they're trying to upgrade it in that fashion. It is it's a quirky place, Cracker Barrel, in some ways. They've got all the merchandise, and people love that. Interesting fact, more of their sales actually comes from the merchandise they sell, that store in the front of the store, than actually the food.
Yeah, because Lord knows you stop when you're traveling and you look at all that stuff and it's like, man, look at this, a fly swatter. I need that.
Exactly right. Yeah, I never knew I needed this wood carved fly swatter, but I do. I need two of them, actually.
Sure, absolutely. And what about Aunt Agnes? So would they have done better to maybe, I'm looking at the old logo with the guy sitting in the chair. Somebody texted and they did away with the cracker and the barrel. I guess the sign that Cracker Barrel was typed on was supposed to be a cracker. Is that what I'm missing here? The background?
I guess. I've never been totally sure on the shape
of the
old logo there.
From what you're telling me, they would have done better to maybe remove the chair and have the guy leaning on a barrel next to the sign. Then the next thing, after a couple of years, remove the barrel and have the guy leaning on the sign. Then before you know it, 3 years later, the guy is leaning on a new sign, and then after another couple of years, no, I'm being serious here. I'm not joking.
It's true.
The guy is gone, right?
100%. Little step-by-step changes don't get big reactions because each little step, and then you get used to the one, and then you change it again. But I think they said that would have been very inefficient to do that and taken a long time. You know, it's interesting. You can't even, in the old logo, it's hard to even see the character particularly well. It's a, the old logo was not really a work of art, I think. But the change was big enough. And I think the change in the logo connected to the change in the restaurants. And they said, it's not just that you're changing the logo, you're changing this whole restaurant operation, and you're shifting it from what it was, this sort of traditional place, into this newer place, and that's so sad and so annoying. And that's what's gotten people really fired up on it. The other piece is there's nobody really supporting the new one. Nobody's saying, I love the new one. So all you hear right now on all the social media is people saying, I don't like the
And I gotta believe they focus group this a lot with different logos before they decided on this one. They didn't just sit around a table and go, yeah, I like that one. Let's do this.
You would have to imagine they did, and they certainly did it for renovations to the restaurants. And they, when you make a change like this, especially to restaurants, ideally what you want to do is you change a few of them, and then you watch what happens. Do people like it? Do they come back more frequently? How does it affect sales? And then you learn if it's a good change. I bet, you know, that's what they're going to do, and they've said that now, and I think that's right. Sort of make little changes now and see how it goes, and then figure out the next step.
Let me take a break. We come back, we'll talk about Elon Musk rechristening Twitter as X, HBO, what's going on there. I don't know. 6:53, traffic now, WWL. 6:57, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Tim Calkins, our friend, clinical professor of marketing at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. You guys coming down to play Tulane this weekend, Tim?
I think that's exactly right.
I know it's right.
It's going to be a good game.
Make it ready. It's going to be hot. That's all I'm saying. It's going to be hot. Let's talk about this HBO thing, because, again, and I don't mean to give energy or channel my inner curmudgeon, but I don't care what you call it, so long as I don't have to provide 15 different types of logins when I try to watch something. And then once I do log in, try to find something that entertains me on HBO Max. Tell me about the name change here.
Well, HBO is astonishing because, you know, that brand has changed the name so often. And it was HBO, then it was HBO Max, then it was just Max, and now it's HBO Max again. And they keep revising the name and keep changing the name. And at this point, people think it's almost comical how much and how quickly they change the name of that. But the reason they keep changing it, they're trying to figure out, how do you compete against Netflix and how do you win in the streaming wars? And that's a tough battle. But that's a case where they've changed it so much that it becomes confusing. It's hard to keep up with what the latest name for HBO
is. Was that a rhetorical question about how do you compete? Because I would say better content and easier login procedures, but you were just rhetorically saying that, right?
Well, I think those things certainly work, but you know, Netflix is so powerful and so big, they've got the resources to produce so much content. It is a challenge for the other companies.
Professor, do you have any, I don't know, you can things be focus grouped to death? I don't know if you, people even know what a focus group, but before Katrina, we're talking about that this week, they had a lot of malls in the area, and you'd be walking around and people would buttonhole you to come in and take part in a focus group. Can you over focus group something? Can you focus group yourself into a bad decision?
I think you definitely can. And the problem with the focus group, and again, it's good to get people together to get their reactions to things, but the problem with the focus group is that, you know, the people who are giving you feedback are going to tell you what they think today. And the problem is that it's not about what are they going to think a year from now, because nobody knows what they're going to think a year from now.
Thank you, Professor.
They're just going to tell you what they think today.
Appreciate it. Appreciate your time. We'll be back with Walter Legere. It is 7:15. We continue to remember Katrina, the 20th anniversary. We're going to spend an hour with Walter Legere in a second, but I asked you about expressions that you remembered from Katrina, and I said mine was, you're doing a heck of a job, Brownie. Somebody else said, stuck on stupid from General Honoré. That's a good one. The mayor's Chocolate City comment. That was in January, of course, after the storm on Martin Luther King Day. The phrase I'll never forget is, I just learned to text. Somebody else said, when someone calls the Ninth Ward the Lower Nine, it is incorrect. I'm from the Ninth Ward. New Orleanians were called refugees instead of evacuees. Drove me crazy. FEMA fix everything, my you know what. And how y'all made out with the storm in that? Walter Leger joins us now, attorney, former member of the Louisiana Recovery Authority. Well, more than member. How you doing, Walt? Counselor? Good morning.
I am great. How are you, Tommy?
I'm good.
Yeah, reflecting on things. By the way, one phrase I remember is one that we greeted each other with, and that was, how'd you do?
Yep, not, absolutely. How'd you do?
How are you?
How'd you do? How'd you make out?
Yeah, and that meant how many feet of water did you get?
Yep. Walter, I'm one thing that came out of Katrina is a friendship with you that I'm deeply appreciative of. But let's start with St. Bernard Parish, because that's where you're from, and then we'll work forward the road home. Tell me your story.
My story is we evacuated. You know, I was in the ninth grade when Hurricane Betsy hit.
Mm-hmm.
And while New Orleans didn't hit too badly, it was pretty devastating to St. Bernard. So as I grew up, and raised my children in the parish. Whenever a storm came, we loaded them in the minivan, put life jackets on them, and got out of Dodge.
Mm.
So we evacuated to Baton Rouge, stayed in my sister's house. My daughter's house. She was a student at LSU, and we stayed there for the storm itself. Within a day or two, all my kids were there. My son Walt was an assistant district attorney in New Orleans at the time. We went exploring. We rented a condo in Baton Rouge. We knew we were getting no news out of St. Bernard. We knew if a path of the storm, St. Bernard would have been devastated. And we were very anxious over the fact that we had good friends in government who had stayed and weren't hearing from them. So Walt and I went about the city once we got this condo to buy a sofa and a TV and some inflatable mattresses. And we heard on the radio that the Secretary of the Council had called and said that there were a few thousand people that had been evacuated after the storm, after the flood, into the warehouse at the St. Bernard Port, and they couldn't get out because there was no way to get any vehicles in there. Walt and I went to the TV station that had also apparently, according to my daughter, had been broadcasting that same thing. I got on the air. I gave people my cell phone, and I said, look, if you got a boat, call me.
Mm.
We're going down to the parish.
Mm.
Yeah.
You see, that's leadership, because you could have just stayed in a condo or, you know what I mean, and just see what happened.
No, I couldn't.
No, you understand what I'm saying, though.
Yeah, yeah. I know what you're saying, but it was like, they needed help. And we were just going to do it. Walt and I actually, then we found the governor's emergency operations center, and using Walt's district attorney badge, we kind of talked our way in, saw Andy Coplin there, who was then the chief of staff, the governor, and they were already formulating a plan to get down to St. Bernard, among many other plans, and asked me if I could help them find the way there. And we actually, two other staff members were assigned to me, Sam Jones and Ty Brummel, and we took a car down the West Bank. We got to the Crescent City Connection and to the docks there, flagged down a pilot boat, a Crescent City pilot. But meanwhile, the president of the bar pilots, the Associated Branch pilots, called me. I was their lawyer. He said, hey, did you forget about us? We got boats.
Let me just throw something in here. Walt Leger's dad was a boat pilot for a long time, right?
He was. My grandfather was a ship captain. My dad was a ship captain. Then he became a pilot, a bar pilot. And by the way, my brother's a pilot now, and so is my youngest son.
Wow. Okay.
So we've got a lot of salt in our veins.
So you flag them down. They said, don't forget about us. And what happened?
Yeah, he said, we got boats, and we have the boats in the Chalmette Slip right next to the warehouse.
Hmm.
If you can make your way to there are two sea lift command ships, those gray ships that are always docked near the old port of embarkation and the industrial canal. The port people are staying on there. If you can make your way there, we'll help out. So, by the way, the plan that we had concocted was I was to commandeer the two ferries at Algiers and get the ferries down to St. Bernard, but not until we knew we had buses in Algiers.
Who's going to drive the ferries or steer them or whomever, the pilots?
Well, what I did, I went to the ferries and talked to the captain. The ferry captains were there.
Okay.
But they and I convinced them that I had the authority of the governor, which was, you know, only half true.
Well, let truth get in the way of a good story. Let me take a break. Well, when it comes to an emergency like that, let me take a break. Walt, we'll pick it up here. We'll come back real quick before I forget. What happened to your home?
Oh, my home was devastated. We had over 15 feet of water. Everything on the ground floor was totally not just destroyed, but I mean, it was like a mixer. Yeah. Inside the home, like so many other people.
Right. We're not ignoring any area. We each day we're trying to focus on a different area. And I remember seeing the videos of St. Bernard when that water came up, and that was terrifying to see. 722, we'll pick it up. We come back. Walter Leger is spending the hour with us. Traffic Now, WWL. 727, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Walter Leger, attorney, former member of Louisiana Recovery Authority. I think you were the chairman of that, weren't you, Walter?
No, actually, I was not. I did during the Jindal administration, though, when he downsized it, became the vice chairman and ultimately co-chair when the chairman became ill.
Because I want to hear the story about Kathleen Blanco calling you, but that's after the news. Right now, I want to go back to you commandeering a ferry boat and what happened from there, or attempting to commandeer a ferry boat. Did you?
Yeah, we actually did, it was all on faith and everyone doing the right, wanting to do the right thing. But we had to wait until we knew we had, the school buses. The governor's plan was to get school buses from North Louisiana, get them over to the Algiers landing. The communication was horrible, but we did have DHF on the pilot boats, and on the ferry for that matter. And so once we got word that the buses were coming, we launched we took the ferries down to the St. Bernard port. And I'm telling you, Tommy, when I walked into that warehouse, the executive director today tells me that they believe there were about 5,000 people in there. Mm. It looked like a horror movie. They looked like zombies.
Just shell shocked. Right.
2 or 3 days in the heat, without food or water.
Having lost everything.
Oh, and they had just been actually, rescued from their homes by what was left, the sheriff's department and the firemen who had commandeered boats to go to people's homes. And so they were just starting to get some water. But it was just terrifying looking. But
what day is this, Walter? Chronologically, what are we talking about here? What day?
This would have been maybe Wednesday.
Okay.
Maybe Wednesday after the storm, a couple of days afterwards. Because as you may remember, we were in Baton Rouge. The TV in Baton Rouge, national news was saying New Orleans has been spared.
Mm-hmm.
In New Orleans, the water rose slowly in New Orleans, but we knew St. Bernard had been devastated because, it was right in the path, and the levees on Mr. Go, by the way, they didn't just breach. They just disappeared like sandcastles on a beach.
Real quick, before we go to news, where'd you take the people on a ferry?
So we went there and gathered the people up, and I mean, there was a breeze on the river. As they got on the ferries, they started cheering, and people were happy, and I was hugging people, and we were all kind of crying, and then we took them up to the Algiers ferry landing across the river, where the governor had arranged and had sent maybe 85 school buses. And as people got off the ferries, they got onto the school buses, and they sent them off to wherever.
Well, thank goodness, because that was before downtown flooded, right?
Downtown was probably flooding at about that time.
So if you had not done that...
They didn't want to bring them back into New Orleans.
Right, but if you had not done that, those people, I don't know what they would have done.
I guess we'd have gotten them out some way, somehow.
I guess
that was the plan.
Might have taken a ferry to Baton Rouge.
Many went to Baton Rouge.
I'm saying you might have taken a ferry to Baton Rouge if the city had flooded.
Oh, no. I mean, we could have.
Yeah.
Actually, at the same time, people were calling me on my cell phone, and people were bringing boats down from up the river. from Baton Rouge loaded with underwear and water and, you know, and utensils and toothbrushes and stuff. There were, look, people were loading barges and stuff with all kind of things for survivors.
Let me take a break. Walter, we'll pick it up. We'll pick it up when we come back. We're talking to Walter Leger about Katrina. And Mr. Go was something else you brought up that, man, you know, I remember doing interviews. I know we got to go, but back in the 90s with people who told me exactly what was going to happen with the Mr. Go, and it did, but nobody listened. Finally, they did. We'll take a break, come back more with Walter Leger. Time now, WWL First News. 7:46, quickly back to Walter Leger, attorney, former Maryland, Louisiana Recovery Authority. We've already talked about St. Bernard and the damage there. Well, tell me about, you're driving in your car, you get a call from Governor Kathleen Blanco, right? Do I remember that correctly?
Yeah, you're right. After all of that, we began trying to recover with respect to my family and our homes, and I'm going back and forth to Baton Rouge quite a bit. If you remember in those days, you really often lost cell coverage somewhere between New Orleans and Baton Rouge. Well, I'm driving to Baton Rouge, and my phone rings in my car, and the voice is, Mr. Leger. I said, yes. She said, this is Governor Blanco. Well, with that, I pulled over the side of the road. I didn't want to lose the governor.
Yeah, it'll get your attention.
And I had I really didn't know Governor Blanco at the time. And she proceeded to tell me, look, I'm putting together an organization, a commission that's going to rebuild Louisiana. We're going to be bipartisan. We'll have Republicans and Democrats. We're not going to be political, but we're going to do what we can to rebuild Louisiana. Understand that, that you would like to probably be involved in something like this. I said, are you kidding? Absolutely. She said, well, would you agree to serve? I said, Governor, I'll be there 24/7. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know, Tommy, how many 24s and how many 7s yes. there would be. but I was honored. And then within a few weeks, we all got together and started trying to put the state back together.
How do you even begin to do that, Walter? What was the thought around the table? You got the best and the brightest, hopefully, around the table talking about how do we do this, how do we do that. The thought was to get money into people's hands as quickly as you could so they could use it to rebuild?
Well, if you remember, yes, we had some really good people on it. Norman Francis was the chairman. The vice chairman was Walter Isaacson. Donna Brazil was on it. Mary Madeline from the Republican side.
And Walter Isaacson told me day before yesterday that at one point it came up, it's like no political agenda here. There are no Democrats, no Republicans, right?
That's exactly what our instructions were and our feelings were. Mm-hmm. This is about, it doesn't matter, politics doesn't matter. People have lost their homes. We had over 200,000 homes destroyed. We had 220,000 businesses destroyed. And we had, you know, 40 schools destroyed. 835 schools severely damaged. So we were in trouble. D's and R's didn't matter. But the other side of it was what suddenly dawned upon us, the first tranche of money sent down by the federal government sent about $5 billion to Mississippi and $6 billion to us. Well, no offense to Mississippi, but we had five, by all measures, we had 5 to 10 times the damage they had. And we simply needed more money to be able to begin a rebuilding program and to rebuild the state. I mean, a poor state like Louisiana can't afford to rebuild a disaster of this magnitude. The biggest, by the way, national disaster in the history of America. Mm-hmm. Our assignment was let's develop a plan. We hired experts. We debated. We argued. We tried to learn things and my assignment was partially to go to Washington with the governor. I testified before 5 or 6 congressional committees, and the governor's thought was, as a homeowner, I would appreciate, you know, and empathize with what all of us had gone through, and might be a little bit more credible to members of Congress as a litigation lawyer, that I should be able to make the case persuasively. And so that's kind of how we undertook it. We launched the whole rebuilding program before it was complete.
Walter,
you know,
was that
we
when
we were building as we were sailing?
Was that when Mitch Landrieu addressed the? I think he was lieutenant governor at the time and addressed the issue of corruption, because I remember hearing that on the air on WWL, and he said, "Look, before we get into that, let's talk about Chicago, Philadelphia. Everybody has corruption, so don't let that hinder right."
One thing that we were committed to, and the governor, of course, I mean, I became a great admirer of Governor Blanco, and her attitude was, yes, we have a history of corruption in Louisiana. These programs, particularly the road home, will not be corrupt. We will not have, we're going to have double, we're going to make sure the nation understands we can do it right. And by the way, when you look back historically, that's one of the things we have to be very proud of. We built some protections in, which may have some degree slowed things down, but it also helped us get additional funding. And I think we largely avoided any real scandals or hints of corruption.
Walter, did you not tell me, and I told Walter Isaacson this the other day, and I fumbled for the word, but the word was succession, that a lot of the delays were because estates had never been settled, and people were afraid to go to succession because they were afraid that somebody was going to steal a house from them?
Well, that's particularly true in the context of the Road Home program. You had, in order to get funds, you had to demonstrate that you were the person that had title. In order to even sell it to the state, you had to have title. And particularly in the lower Ninth Ward, for example, many of these homes had been in families for generations and had been passed to some relative, but the successions had never been opened and ownership not declared. We had a title insurance company that was examining titles, et cetera, and there was difficulties in clearing title for many, 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 many homes. That did slow things down somewhat, but eventually we fought through it and worked through it.
What worked best, Walter?
I'm sorry?
What worked best with the Road Home program?
Well, I think, well, for one thing, it was a battle. It was a battle to get funding. It was a battle with HUD. We were told the CDBG money, the community development block grant money that was coming down to allow us to rebuild, was the easiest money, federal money, to spend. If that's true, I don't know how they ever spend any money. The red tape and the strings attached were tremendous. But we developed a program with HUD people embedded in Baton Rouge in the governor's office, giving us waivers to try to move things along quickly. Developed the program initially, which would have provided full funding, we think, including if the grants themselves didn't complete the necessary cost of construction. We had forgivable loans and affordable loans attached to the rear end that local banks had agreed to give. But suddenly on March 7th of 2007, HUD, for some reason, some people say political, some people say political, just actually told us no, ended the program. So, and told us we just had to start, you know, paying money and writing checks. Well, you can't just write checks. There has to be some calculated formula. At the end of the day, what worked? We ended up rebuilding 130,000 homes through the Road Home program for people of lower economic assets and resources and income. We developed a thing called an additional compensation grant to help boost a little bit more some of those funds. I by the way, still today chair of the Louisiana Land Trust, which is the organization that was created to receive people's homes, that people that wanted to sell their homes under what we call option three, would be sold to the state, but actually go to the Louisiana Land Trust. And the task of the land trust was to eventually demolish those homes, refurbish the property, keep the property, the grass cut, et cetera, and return it to commerce, so homes could be rebuilt. That was 12,500 homes, about 4,500 in St. Bernard, about 4,200 in New Orleans. Today, every single one of those pieces of property has been returned.
Walter, thank you so much for your time. Soon, you, me, and Walt III at Galatoire's on Friday afternoon. This time, it's my treat, okay?
No. But by the way, you said it at the beginning, one of the real benefits of having gone through this horrible disaster is the friendship that we made between you and I.
Amen.
And my son.
So amen,
thank
brother.
You, Tommy, for everything you do.
Thank you. I'm a member of the Leger family, an honorary member. 7:55, 5 till 8, traffic now, WWL. The Katrina story is your story. Our story, New Orleans story. Friday on the anniversary of the storm, you can join WWL for a special day-long broadcast featuring me, Newell Norman, and Dave Cohen, and Scoot live from the Presbyterian in historic Jackson Square from 6 a.m. to 4 p.m. You can hear interviews you haven't heard before about the rescue, recovery, and rebirth in one of our America's most beloved cities, brought to you by Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser and Louisiana State Museums. And there's an amazing free symposium, too, Living with Hurricanes. And that is Katrina and Beyond, Imagine for the Next Generation, from 10 a.m. until noon. And one block away at La Petite Theater, moderated by Norman Robinson, features Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser, Walter Isaacson, Aaron Broussard, former mayor of Lafitte, Tim Kerner. You can tour then the updated exhibition at the Presbyterian from noon till 4, free and open to the public. And one of the sadder things that I remember about Katrina was NOPD spokesperson Paul Accardo that checked out a body bag and then zipped himself up in it in his patrol car and took his own life. And he was just, I know he lost his home and he was depressed about everything that was going on in the city. And it was one of the more, every loss is important, but that one really struck me for whatever reason. 8:11, we'll take a break, talk to Ronald Surpass when we come back on WWL. Now? Okay. 8:16, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Ronald Surpass, our friend, professor of practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD chief, head of the Washington State Police and the Nashville City Police, consultant to numerous police departments and organizations. You see him on TV occasionally, on national TV. How you doing, Chief?
I'm doing good, Tommy. Just got back from California and one of the larger agencies there, and looking at the things they're fighting to do the best job they can, just like happens in New Orleans every day.
So let's talk about Katrina. I know you were not, were you here for that or not? No.
No, I was the chief in Nashville.
That's what I figured. So let's talk about preparing a department for something like this. Did Katrina change the way superintendents or chiefs of police go about preparing departments for a major disaster like this?
No question about it. I mean, when I was the number two chief with Pennington and a gentleman named Jimmy Treadaway, one of our majors, we rebuilt the entire radio infrastructure system and did a redundancy, did two versions, right? Nobody ever would have expected Katrina would have knocked both of those out. So that was a learning point. Another learning point, and it's basic to command and control, if you can't communicate with the people who work for you, then you can't communicate direction and accountability and responsibility. So we actually created, as though many departments, call-out lists. So if an officer, if another Katrina had happened during our time from 2010 to 2014, officers would have known where to go if they had no contact from us. If the whole radio system failed again, they would know where to go, and we would know where to expect to find them. That was one of the things that happened to Katrina, totally unexpected by the department. They really didn't know where a lot of people were. The third thing is that when you think about what happened during the Dome, during the Super Bowl in 2013, again, no one expected that the lights would completely go out in the Dome. So then you have to start reassessing, well, how would you get 70,000 people out of the Dome as quickly as you could had the lights actually gone permanently? Were our plans sufficient? Did we tabletop it? Did we exercise it? So where I just came from in California, they have a lot of exercises they need to do for earthquakes and fires. So basically the message is you learn every time how to be better in the event it happens again, because nobody can think of everything.
You know,
experience is what helps you.
One thing I know, remembers that of the uniforms being stolen, then they didn't know who was were the police officers and who weren't. That's something, I guess, that was gleaned from this, where you have to somehow secure uniforms, or is there any way to do that if an officer's home gets burglarized or whatever? I don't know. Tell me about that.
Well, absolutely, that's an issue. And one of the things New Orleans does not have is a uniform shop that it owns, right, a quartermastering system. Mm-hmm. Nashville has a quartermastering system. Washington State Patrol has a quartermastering system. We would probably have been able to deal with that quicker. However, you're right. These are the lessons that you learn after you plan and after you plan. And look, New Orleans, Tommy, I've lived here all my life. You've lived here all your life. Hurricanes are not unknown to us. They might be unknown to the national media, but we see them every year. And what happens is, and even talking to people in the NOPD who I've worked with all my life and my family, everybody kind of gets to this, nah, well, you know, it's just another storm in the Gulf. It's another storm in the Gulf. My father was a police officer during Betsy and Camille. And I was in Nashville, and I was calling him. He's now passed, rest his soul. I said, Dad, are you leaving? He said, man, look, we've been through this before. About 24 to 48 hours out, I called him because the picture of Katrina over the Gulf was the whole Gulf. I said, what's going on? He said, man, I'm getting the hell out of here. What happens is people get kind of inured. They get kind of used to the same rhythm. And I'm thinking Katrina's one of the best things that happened from that horrible tragedy is I think people are less likely to just say, nah, let's just, it's just another storm. And that's good because the bottom line is this, Tommy. You can't provide public safety and rescue to people who you know are going to be in places where you can't get to them unless they leave. So getting people to recognize the value of leaving where they are so that the police are less responding to those places where you can't get to them, really, and you can do more of the other things you need to do, order maintenance, peacekeeping. So evacuation is crucial. It's really crucial. The sooner you can get people out of harm's way, the more efficient the police department can be at peacekeeping and order maintenance, which means trying to keep people from breaking into your house while you're gone. That kind of thing is a big lesson after Katrina.
And look, I'm all for generators. I was talking to Craig from Craig's Generators at the home show on Sunday. But one concern I have is that people don't realize that power and water are two different things, so that even though you have a generator, if there's a threat of like another Katrina, you still have to go.
Yeah, I think people should trust that the government is getting better technology all the time on forecasting storms, which gives us more time. You know, in the olden days when Nash Roberts was here, I will tell you, he was never wrong. No matter what the technology advancements were of the day, Nash Roberts was always right. But we are better now. And when the city says we're 120 hours out and we've got a 50% certainty that this thing is coming this way, they're going to start messaging that early and often. And hopefully the more people who can move out, the better the government will be at responding to what's left.
All right, let me take a break. We'll talk about the psychological effects on a department when we return. Ronald Serpas, professor of practice, Department of Criminal Justice, Loyola, former NOPD chief, not during Katrina, but has a lot of experience in the police business or the police world, and we'll talk about the psychological effects of something like this on a force when we return. 822 Traffic Now, WWL. 8:27 half, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Our Katrina commemoration continues. We're talking to Ronald Serpas. We pick his brain about police work and crime every week, but we thought we'd talk about dealing with a natural disaster like this, although, to be clear, it was a man-made disaster in New Orleans. It was the poor construction of the levees that caused the problems with the city flooding. How do you go about dealing with the psychological aspects of this with the police force, Chief? Because it changed everybody. Everybody is, in one way or the other, different because of Katrina.
Tommy, I'm going to tell you the honest truth. When I was listening to it from afar, I got a sense of what was going to be an issue. And when I came back, it was confirmed. And here is the issue. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of New Orleans police officers did brave and dramatic things every day. And the handful of people who chose to do incredibly horrific things have cast to the ash heap of history the bravery of hundreds and hundreds of officers. And look, I'll say it, they won't say it, but the cops who were on Napoleon Avenue with water up to their clavicles, who never did anything wrong, who went to work every day, who sacrificed their lives, sacrificed their friends. And then you have what happened in Algiers. You have what happened on the bridge. And what that did is it demoralized the troops, because that's all people talked about, as they should, right? The loss of life at the hands of police is horrible when people were convicted. But the point is, it distracted from the bravery of hundreds of people. The second issue that I think really damaged the morale and psyche of the department as a whole was the runaways, the cops who just said, I'm out. Those two things were crucial in assessing where the NOPD's mental position was when I came back in 10 through 14. And that's the two things I think that hurt the officers personally at their work level involvement, not their homes, not their families, not their houses. But when they know what they were doing and they see what these other people did, and now they know history will reflect on Katrina because of the Danziger Bridge and because of Algiers, that's devastating to their morale. And I think it still is in there someplace.
How do you get police officers to stay? Because part of the problem was a lot of police officers didn't show up and they evacuated. How do you deal with that? Do you get the families out of town? Do you make arrangements for that? And that's what we do here. It's like everybody gets their families out of town, and then you don't have to worry about that, but you're here to do your job. Is that the way you look at it with the police force? Is that an important step in that?
Absolutely. I'm sure Katrina gave us better understanding of how serious to take that. Remember, I was the chief in Nashville when we had the 1,000-year flood, and we had 20, 30 feet of standing water.
That's right, yeah.
But guess what? That water drained away within a day or two because it's a gravity-fed system. Mm-hmm. So I think everybody needed to recognize, and I'm sure we did it when I was a chief, a major, a captain, a lieutenant. But I think Katrina reminded us, you need to be more straightforward with the officers. Hey, look, we're 4 days out. You really need to get your life in order because you have to come back. Everybody in my family, all the females in my family are nurses.
Mm-hmm.
They were all told the same thing. They were told, hey, Katrina's coming. Y'all get yourselves together because you have to come back here and take care of these people who can't leave. That's the nature of public service. Nurses, police officers, firefighters, EMT workers. We have to provide them safety for their families, and there's nothing wrong with that, and it's desired so that we can count on them to come back and help your family. I think Katrina helped really crystallize that point with better planning.
Thank you, Chief. Insights, as always, very interesting. Ronald Surpass, Professor of Practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola. When we come back, we're talking to Steve Geller about the Saints' final roster, who made it, who didn't, and what can we expect. Right now, it's time for WWL First News. 8:45, quarter till 9, joined by Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director. How you doing, Steve?
Oh, man, Tommy, doing fantastic today. Was hurting yesterday, played it out, came home, took some meds, ended up sleeping 10 hours, woke up feeling fantastic. So all is great.
You can't help us if you're not on the field, Steve. You know that,
yes,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Hey, let's talk about that young man at Rummel. He's getting ready.
Oh, you know it. And we got the Jamboree on Friday. Hoss is going to fill in for me on Friday, Sports Talks. So going to get go check out the Jamboree game for Rummel.
When does Rummel play Shaw? Do you know?
I think it's later in the season.
Okay. I'll be there. You'll be there?
All right, cool.
All right, good. Let's talk about the Saints' final 53. Is it the final 53 or not?
The initial 53.
The initial 53. There you go.
Right. You're basically you're set at most positions right now, but there are going to be maneuvers here and there. We've seen the Saints make three trades already, adding to this roster. I don't expect them to sit on their hands either anymore. They're going to still be aggressive, attack the waiver wire with people that have been released by other teams. And we've heard interest from anywhere from running back to punter with this squad. So we definitely think there's still more moves ahead for this team. So not the final 53 yet.
Tell me about Asim Richards. Asim, how do you pronounce his name?
I think you're right, Asim.
Okay.
they're definitely filling a need for that swing, that extra offensive lineman that this Saints team has lost so much depth with this, you know, the preseason. A fifth-round pick from the Dallas Cowboys, spent some, you know, his start of his career there, and definitely someone that you figure will slot more in at the left tackle position is where he's primarily lined up. And, you know, like I said, the depth has just been torched by this team, unfortunately, in the preseason. And the offensive line, the health was an issue last year and looks to be that case again. So definitely a welcome body to a group that's been banged up. Hopefully we don't get to see too much of him, like I said, since he's in a reserve role. But right now, even with guys like, you know, Trevor Penning's dealing with the toe issue, we heard that Talase Fuaga had a knee injury but wasn't deemed anything too serious. Well, I'll feel a lot more comfortable when he's back out there playing.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to the cornerback situation, is that the final six?
That's definitely one of the spots I'm looking at to acquire some more people for the roster, whether it's depth or not.
At the expense of whom?
Yeah, that's then you start looking around at who do you end up trying to maybe move to the practice squad,
right?
But with
sneak through waivers, right? Because you got it in the procedure now. if you move them to practice squad, they got to clear waivers first or not?
Right, exactly. Yeah, okay. So, yeah, there's a whole – you could end up losing the guy to another team if they decide to try and scoop him up. But right now you're looking, I would think Kool-Aid is your starting corner along with Ike Yadom.
Mm-hmm.
And you have Alante Taylor, who's we haven't seen in a while, dealing with a groin issue, that he's the slot corner for you. But nothing has given you any hope that he's going to be ready week one. We haven't seen him on the field forever, hoping that that happens sooner than later. But, you know, you have other depth pieces like a Rajon Wright, Ugo Amadi.
Ugo Amadi's played well in the preseason, has he not?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I would expect him to start in Alante Taylor's slot if Taylor isn't ready.
Mm-hmm.
And then also mentioning real quick, Quincy Riley, the rookie, who has, you know, shown off his prowess of intercepting balls in the preseason and in at training camp. So he could be an addition there. I don't know how quickly they want to throw him out to the Wolves in this defense.
Let me run a crazy idea by you. And somebody texted this in about Justin Reed kicked a field goal, I think, with Kansas City. If the idea now is instead of hitting the full driver when you kick off, instead you're hitting like a little punch four iron to get it to land wherever they want it to land, at the five or whatever. Man, I would have Justin Reed kick off, and so you got an extra player on special teams that can actually play, and no disrespect to Blake Groupie, but his job is pretty much not to get hurt at that point, right?
Yeah, I don't know how precise Reed can be at
doing
that.
Don't call me a squirrel. I'm just saying, having kicked the football only in high school, I know that, but it ain't that hard. If I can do it, it can't be that hard, because I am not an athlete, and I'm just thinking, man, I don't know. Why not? You know, if it makes you more effective on special teams.
You're going to have to come out to the Saints media, I guess, combine, you would call it. They're going to actually have select members punting, kicking, and throwing balls. So I'm going to sign you up for the kicking.
Do that. So, when is it?
It's coming up soon. Definitely, I think, maybe next week, like a Tuesday or Wednesday.
Sign me up, brah. I still got the shoe. All right. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director. We'll pick it up here when we return. 851, 9 till 9, traffic, WWL. 857, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Steve Geller texting me these thing for the media, but it's on September 3rd at 9 o'clock. I'd have to take the day off, and it's punt, pass, and kick. I ain't throwing anything. I ain't punting anything. I'm here to kick the football, and that's it. Six corners, five safeties, five linebackers. That kind of goes to the nature of offenses in the NFL, right, with the passing game, and how likely is that number to change, Steve, at each position?
Yeah, I think the biggest concern for me was, well, how many of those defensive linemen were you going to keep? And the, you know, who ended up making it, not a surprise at all. Glad to see Vernon Broughton, the rookie, getting some action. He's going to be playing defensive end.
Mm-hmm.
Christian Boyd, the backup now, nose tackle, to Devon Godshaw, who's been one of the best additions for this team coming into this season, my opinion. And then you look at, with the linebacker room, really solid guys, DeMario Davis and Pete Werner are your main studs there. And then the rookie and Danny Stutzman, a lot of fans have been latching on to him as one of their, you know, a fan favorite early on.
I latched on to him when the Saints drafted him, because I remember when Oklahoma played LSU, he stood out, and I don't remember players. And for me to remember a guy, he's got to be pretty good, and he's played well this preseason. So is he likely to start?
I think you're going to see him more like cycling in. You know, he's a backup role, basically,
to,
I would think, behind DeMario Davis for that Mike linebacker spot.
Okay.
And you got to love the fact, though, like you saw on his Instagram page while he was at Oklahoma, he's like, I'm like communion, that cracker with the juice.
Well, I don't think we have to go there. Tell me about the punting situation and kicking. Obviously, it's play groupie, but what about punting?
Yeah, Kai Kroger ends up being the Saints punter now, and another new punter going into this season. You look at it, the rookie had a decent showing, I guess you could say, for this squad. But like I said, Adam Schefter had reported the Saints were interested in possibly trading for a punter. So I don't think that position's set.
Mm.
And I would leave Kroger's name in pencil right now on the roster.
Mm. I know he holds on the field goals, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. That was definitely a sign. He was ahead of Burnett.
Blake Groupie's been on fire, so I wouldn't change anything with that, but I don't know. I haven't seen any punt. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. We'll be listening this afternoon. You guys are going to be talking sports, and then tomorrow you'll be at Treasure Chest, right?
Yeah, looking forward. Always our weekend kickoff at Treasure Chest, 4 to 7 o'clock.
All right, we'll be listening. When we come back, we're going to talk to Nick Ewan, a senior editorial director at The Points Guy. We can never get enough of this man, and y'all... We are getting ready to talk about credit cards. Nick Ewan joins us, senior editorial director at The Points Guy. And we're talking about credit card rewards. If you don't, you could be missing out on benefits to help you travel for less. We had him on for an hour last time. It's never enough time. So if y'all have any questions or comments, text them in to 504-260-1870. How you doing there, Nick?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Thanks for taking the time. Let's talk about a young person in college trying to establish credit, wants to get a credit card. Does it matter which card they get, or is it all about getting approved and establishing some credit?
Generally, it's all about getting approved and establishing credit, but the big caveat is if you are in college or just getting started, you can't view the card as just free money. So if you get extended a huge limit, one of the baby steps you could actually take even before you're in college. So if we have any parents out there, think about adding your child or your children as authorized users on your existing credit cards. Some issuers even allow you to set individual spending limits. And then that actually can help them build some additional credit, get comfortable with managing their money. You can review their spending goals, set a budget with them if they have a part-time job. And then once they are out in the world and they're applying for their own credit card, they actually will have a little bit of a credit history. And that can really go a long way towards helping them get started on the right foot.
My kid in college was solicited for a credit card offer, and the kid was at college and I was at home, and I accepted and opened a credit card and put their name on it and then paid the bill every month and just said, you know, look, this is the budget. This is what you got to stick to. But I made sure that that bill was paid right on time. And now that credit card rating that they have is about as good as mine. And he's 29. So it's another way to do it, I guess, right?
Yeah, for sure. And the nice thing, too, is that authorized user doesn't even have to be your family member. If you have a friend who you are maybe looking to, you know, help them boost their credit, I've actually done this before where mm-hmm. I've added someone as an authorized user, even though they're never actually going to be using their card, but it can actually help them build that credit. And the same thing holds true with your children. A little hint, there are a couple of issuers that have no age limit on your authorized users. So believe it or not, my daughter has been an authorized user. She's 10 and a half now. She's been an authorized user on one of my credit cards for over 10 years because I added her when she was an infant. So that's going to give her a real, even though she doesn't actually have a card and is obviously not out there spending, she's building that credit history, and that can be a real boon once they are getting out and applying for their own credits.
10 and a half?
Yeah.
The Dickens, you say. I just wanted to see if we got any Beverly Hillbilly fans out there. So does she now have a credit score?
No. So since she's still underage, she does not have a credit score yet. But when she actually turns 18, that's generally when you will first have the ability to have a credit score. Oftentimes, if someone has had no credit history at that point, they will go on freecreditreport.com or go to any one of the credit bureaus, and they will essentially say not enough information because they don't have a profile on that individual if they have never been an authorized user, if they've never been associated with the line of credit. Whereas my daughter will have had an extended period of time and will potentially be in a much better position to be able to manage her credit and potentially get her own credit card and not have to go through the initial steps of having, you know, a co-signer on the account. So that's another option as well, is as a parent, you can go to a bank with your kid and you can open a credit card where you are co-signing on it, still in their name, but you are essentially saying we are assuming the responsibility for it. And then the other option, a lot of people use this if they are trying to rehab their credit, is what's known as a secured credit card. So this is where you essentially put down a deposit and you essentially are given a credit card that has that deposit that you put down as your line of credit. So if you put down $500, that gives you a line of credit of $500. The nice thing about these is that these are still reported to the credit bureaus. And normally within 6 to 12 months after opening the card, if you're paying your balance in full and showing that you're responsibly managing that line of credit, you can then get your deposit back and convert it to an unsecured credit card where you just have that line of credit and you can then start continuing to build your score over time.
I don't know if you and I had this conversation last time or not, but I know at one point before the financial meltdown, they were sending credit cards out to everybody. And I think people were presuming, well, if they send me this credit card with a $5,000 limit, I can run it up because I can afford it. Somebody's watching over this. Unfortunately, nobody's watching over anything. Are they still sending credit cards out like that?
So it's probably not as bad as it was, but I still, and part of this is probably because I'm very active with pretty much all of the banks with my network of credit cards. I do still get, just yesterday, I got two solicitations in the mail. One was for me from Discover. One was for my wife from Citibank. Mm-hmm. So they are definitely still sending these out. The big thing I would say, though, is any of the paid marketing materials you're getting in the mail, pressure test that information online, because you may find that there are better offers from these different banks than the ones that you are getting solicited for in the mail. And again, just because someone says, hey, we think you are pre-approved for a $10,000 credit limit, that still is not a license to spend $10,000 in a month, unless your income that you're taking in every month is $20,000 a month, then you can easily pay that balance in full and on time, because credit card lines are not free money. I really cannot emphasize that enough.
You know why I mentioned that, Nick, how somebody could be so idiotic as to think that just because I got this credit card, that means somebody's watching it and I must be able to spend $5,000 and load it up. You know how I know that? Because I did it. That's why. As a young man, I made that very bad mistake, and I try to get that across. Somebody texted in and said, I'd like to know if it's best to try to make arrangements with my credit card companies to go through one of those agencies that consolidate everything for you. My income has changed drastically in the last year. I can't keep paying just interest every month.
Yeah, I would say any of the debt relief companies that are out there, it's definitely worth having a conversation to see what they are able to do. One of the other nice things as well is there are a number of options for balance transfer credit cards. These aren't going to give you rewards necessarily, but instead they will allow you in many cases to move an existing balance for a one-time fee to a new card, and then you can actually pay, they typically give you a period of interest-free 0% APR to pay down that balance, where instead of just paying interest, you're paying the balance and it's going towards the principal. Now, a couple of important notes there. Number one, there is a fee associated with it. It's typically $5 to 3%, but it does vary, and you can't do that within in a bank where you already have a balance. So if you're already sitting with a balance with Chase, for example, you can't open a balance transfer card with Chase and then move that balance because it's still within the same issuer network. Mm-hmm. But a balance transfer credit card is definitely something that could work there, but also having a conversation with some of those debt consolidation companies to really see what they're able to do. Because at the end of the day, credit card companies, they want you to pay it back. They don't want you to default and just simply never pay it back. So if they can work out a deal to get you to pay some of it back or give you an extended payment timeline with a lower interest, they're going to work with some of these companies to try to give you a pathway to doing so. And that can also then help your credit in the long run.
Somebody wants to know about green light cards for kids and if they build credit. I don't know anything about a green light card. What is that?
Yeah, so there are a number of cards that have popped up to really help the younger individuals build credit. I've not personally investigated the green light. I know we have a couple of our team members here at the Points Guy who have, but really there are a number of different products out there that allow you to help build credit and build financial responsibility. And this is one of the real important things. You talked about your experience with running up debt. Mm-hmm. I've talked to a lot of friends, a lot of family members who simply didn't know otherwise. They were not given the education that they needed to really be financially literate when it came to managing their credit cards and budgeting and everything like that. So regardless of whether you're looking at a green light card or adding your kid as an authorized user, the best thing that you can do as a parent is to teach your kid how to responsibly manage their money. If they are paying their rent and they are, you know, paying their utilities when they first get out of college and they only have a few hundred dollars left of disposable income, it's going to be very hard for them to go and spend $3,000 on a concert ticket that they really, really want to go to. So that's the most important thing, is really teaching your kid about budgeting and financially managing their money, regardless of what product you're using to do that when they're younger.
Somebody texted in, is it sound advice to say never charge anything on a credit card that you can't pay in 30 days, that you can't clear the balance out every month?
Absolutely. Spending within your means is one of the most important things. The only caveat I would give there is if you do have a huge purchase coming up, you know that there's going to be something that you can't afford. There are a number of credit card offerings that do offer you a period of interest-free. Sometimes it's 0% APR, which basically means you don't have to pay that balance off at all until the end of that period. But of course, if you don't, then you're all of a sudden going to be nailed with interest. I actually took advantage of this. My dog, my beloved child, my first child, my canine child, had some major, major medical surgery at the beginning of last year. We're talking about, you know, low five figures worth of surgery. That was not something that my wife and I had sitting in our bank accounts that we were able to afford. We didn't want to liquidate any of our, you know, investments. So we actually opted for a 0% APR credit card that gave us 15 months to pay off that balance. Mm-hmm. And we made sure we paid the balances each month, kind of debited it down. And by the end of it, we were able to cover the entire thing. So a good rule of thumb is absolutely pay. Do not charge anything to your credit card that you cannot afford to pay off within 30 days when your statement closes. But again, if you do have one of those large expenses, there are ways to help mitigate that with some interest-free financing options.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. Texts are pouring in. Somebody wants to know, if someone's trying to decide on a new credit card, how would you advise them between picking one that's geared towards cash back versus travel rewards? Somebody else wants to know, says, my partner and I take a couple of trips a year and we have good credit. Is there a good card we could get to help make some of these vacations a little cheaper? Somebody else said, my husband and I go to restaurants or order delivery 3 or 4 times a week. What would be our best options? So we'll talk about all that when we come back with Nick Ewan, Senior Editorial Director at The Points Guy. We'll also talk about what The Points Guy is when we come back. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Pardon me, 9:27 now, talking to our friend Nick Ewan, Senior Editorial Director at The Points Guy. Quickly, Nick, what is The Points Guy?
Yeah, so The Points Guy is a website. We also have a YouTube, a couple YouTube channels and some social media accounts where we cover everything that travelers need to know to maximize their credit card rewards and loyalty programs to travel more for less.
All right, to the text lines we go and help the customers. If someone's trying to decide on a new credit card, how would you advise them on picking between one that's geared towards cash back versus travel rewards?
I think that the big question is how much time you want to invest in learning the ins and outs of the travel rewards ecosystem. I will say I've been doing this for over 20 years now, and the well goes deep when it comes to figuring out all the nuances and the tips and tricks and everything like that. There are a lot of people who are busy and don't have the wherewithal to really dig into all of that. So cashback may simply be the better option, especially if you're not necessarily traveling all the time, because cash can be used for utility bills. It can be used to cover clothing. It can be used to cover groceries. So it does have that additional flexibility. But if you do want the opportunity to maximize your rewards and you are willing to put in some time and energy, a travel card may be a better option for you.
Is there a rule of thumb about how much travel do you do for it to be worth the travel rewards?
I think that's a good rule of thumb. You know, if you're taking, you know, one road trip a year and maybe a flight every 3 or 4 years, a travel rewards card is probably not going to give you enough payoff to go beyond what you would get from a simple cashback card. Remember, there are a lot of handful of cashback cards out there that give you 2% back on every purchase you make with no annual fee. So that you should think of as your baseline. If I can get more value than that by leveraging a travel rewards card that maybe gives me bonus points in specific categories that I know I spend a lot in, then that could be a good option. But if you are thinking 2% back on everything I purchase, that I could use that cash for anything, that sounds pretty good. Then that may be a better option for you.
So when it comes to cards that you pay for, like American Express, or what else do you pay for?
It depends. Pretty much every issuer has cards that run the gamut of $0 up to $400, $500, $600, $700 per year. So there's a huge range of products out there.
So I guess what I'm asking is, you know, because you and I had this conversation last time, I always wanted American Express Platinum, but I don't really travel, and I'm not going to pay $795 a year or whatever it is. Unless you do travel, are those paid cards worth it?
It really depends, and this is where it's so important, especially in recent weeks, months, years, we've seen these annual fees really grow higher and higher and higher. So previously, $450 was kind of the upper bound of where these cards are. We now have a personal credit card out there that has a $795 annual fee, and that's the Chase Sapphire Reserve. Now, I am a Chase Sapphire Reserve cardholder, and it is worth it to me as someone who travels frequently. So it's really important, regardless of whether a card charges a $95 annual fee or a $795 annual fee, you've got to crunch the numbers and identify the benefits that it offers and actually put a value on that, a real dollar value that you think you are getting out of each one of those benefits. And then once you've done that, tally up the value of the benefits, compare it to the annual fee. The benefits outweigh the annual fee, then it's worth keeping. If they don't, then you might want to consider downgrading it.
And you're talking about now air travel, right? Not road travel.
It really depends, because there are some credit cards that offer bonus points on gas purchases and give you, you know, a variety of other benefits as well. In addition to the increasing annual fees, another trend that we've seen over the last several years has been this kind of increasing push into non-travel benefits. So even the American Express Platinum card, obviously, it's kind of the king for premium travel, or has been the longest running premium travel card out there. But it has a ton of non-travel perks you can get on the card right now, like $20 a month towards select digital entertainment providers like the New York Times and Hulu. Those are things that can really put money back in your pocket if you already subscribe to these platforms, and adding this card to your wallet can actually get you money back. So yes, these are travel cards, but they've really tried to expand their kind of coverage into these lifestyle non-travel areas. So that's really where you have to look and say, how often am I going to be using these benefits? Whether it's lounge access in an airport, whether it's the streaming benefits, whether it's hotel credits or elite status, and really identify, is this worth it for me in my personal unique situation?
But how would you go about assigning a dollar value to that?
So some of them are pretty simple. The digital entertainment credit, for example, on the Amex Platinum, that's $20 a month. Relatively simple. If you're already paying for one of these platforms, that is going to be $20 a month back in your pockets. That's $240 in a year. So right there, that's a good chunk of your annual fee. Mm-hmm. Now, something like lounge access, that's a lot harder to put a true value on. So that's where it does become a little bit more subjective. Now, if you're the type of person who's like, you know what, I'm rarely in an airport. And even when I am, I'm trying to time it where I don't have to spend any extra time in the airport. I want to drop my bags and get to the plane and walk right on. Then lounge access, you may want to assign a $0 value to that. Mm-hmm. It's really up to your own specific circumstance, but really going through that exercise, even putting it down on paper to really detail out, this is the quantifiable value I'm getting from this card, can really help you in identifying, is this worth it to me? And you may find out that it's not.
We've gotten a couple of texts from people planning trips out of the country. Can you talk about foreign transaction fees and how people can kind of avoid them?
Yeah, for sure. So this is a really key thing, and a lot of people don't necessarily realize. One of the great things is that cards like Visa and MasterCard, even American Express now, are accepted almost anywhere that you go. Obviously, there are exceptions. There are some small businesses that are going to be cash only. But one of the big things that people don't necessarily realize is just because your card is accepted, that doesn't mean it's accepted with no fee. So there are a lot of cards, especially the no annual fee ones, that do impose, typically it's 2.7 to 3% for every single transaction that you make outside of the country. So a simple way to avoid those is to get a card that waives those annual fees. And there are a number of them out there. Most of them do have annual fees, but there are a few. Capital One in particular is known for having cards that don't charge foreign transaction fees and also have no annual fee. So I know some readers here at the Points Guy who have their cards that they love that they use every day in the U.S., but they actually keep a separate one that they use when they travel outside the country because it waives those foreign transaction fees. So really, even if you're just traveling outside of the country once a year, once every other year, a great tip is to have a card that's going to save you on those transaction fees.
This is an interesting text. Somebody wants to know if the credit cards that charge fees are more or less picky when it comes to credit scores.
That's a great question. So let me start by saying, generally speaking, any card that offers any kind of rewards, whether it's cash back, whether it's airline miles, whether it's travel points, are generally going to have relatively high requirements to get approved for them. Typically, you're looking for very good, if not excellent, credit. You can get approved in maybe the low 600s, but generally you'll be in the, you need to be in the 700s, if not in the 800s, to really maximize your approval odds. So rewards cards in general tend to be the ones that have those higher approval requirements. The difference in the annual fees typically isn't a huge thing. It's generally all rewards cards in general. But bear in mind, too, that just because you have a high credit score doesn't mean you're guaranteed to get approved. We've seen people with credit scores of 810, 820, 830. I mean, that's approaching a perfect credit score. Still get rejected for cards because there's something else in their credit history, or maybe they have already gotten too many new cards, or they have too much credit that has been extended to them. So there are a number of other factors that go into it beyond just that numerical number. So again, you want to try to increase that score as much as possible to maximize your odds of getting approved.
Somebody texted in and said, my husband and I, let me find this here, go to restaurants 3 or 4 times a week and get takeouts. What would be the best card for us?
There are a lot of options out there. Obviously, you know, the kind of lifestyle rewards, that's become an increasingly important thing, especially to the younger generation. So there are many cards out there that offer bonus points on dining purchases, including takeout services. One of our favorites here at the Points Guy is the Chase Sapphire Preferred Cards. That'll give you 3 points per dollar you spend at every restaurant. The American Express Gold Card is another one that offers 4 points per dollar at restaurants across the world. Those cards do come with annual fees, so it's important to keep that in mind. But this is part of when it comes to choosing your next card. I love this question because it shows they're already thinking about, how should I be choosing my next card? Looking at where you're spending your money can be a real critical aspect of that. If you're a big family, you don't really travel a ton, but you have huge grocery bills, mm-hmm. Look for a card that's going to give you bonus points or extra cash back at your grocery store. If you dine out a lot, like this couple that just wrote in, look for a card that gives you bonus points on restaurants or bonus points on those delivery or takeout services. So really matching your spending to the cards, that's going to be a key way to help really boost the rewards that you're taking home.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. Texts are pouring in, 504-260-1870. We're talking to our friend Nick Ewan, Senior Editorial Director at The Points Guy, about credit card rewards. If you're not paying attention to it, you could be missing out on benefits to help you travel for less. I charge everything on a credit card, paid off 30 days, and use the points when I get enough to use as payment toward the card for the things that I charged, and that helps debt. We'll take a break, come back. Right now, time for traffic on WWL. Especially when we're talking to Nick Ewan, Senior Editorial Director at The Points Guy. Nick, somebody texted in and said, my husband and I don't travel per se, but each weekend we travel to some of the finer restaurants in the city of New Orleans. And I guess the tab, they say, goes to like 250 plus every weekend. So is there a credit card that really would cater to that?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of good options. Number one would be just a general card that offers bonus points on dining, regardless of what restaurant you choose. The other thing I would potentially look at is American Express has a partnership with Resy, the booking platform, R-E-S-Y. If any of those nicer restaurants that they're going to on a regular basis are on the Resy platform, there are a couple of cards that offer credits in different amounts and different timelines. So I mentioned before the American Express Gold Card. That gives you 4 points per dollar spent at all of your restaurants. But then you also do get every 6 months, you basically get $50 off a restaurant on the Resy platform. So I always make sure to try to go to one of those restaurants with my wife and daughter at least every 6 months to be able to enjoy a nice meal, but then also get $50 off the tab when the card is charged. So there are definitely some interesting ones to look at there.
Ain't nothing wrong with that. Somebody else texted in here. Let me scroll because I got a lot of them and I want to take them in the order that they came in. Credit card rewards can be complicated if somebody has the time to learn those ins and outs. As you have said, what are some of the best travel cards for them? Alternatively, if somebody just wants a simple, easy to understand travel card, what are those options?
Yeah, so I think simple, easy to understand would be a card like the Chase Sapphire Preferred or the Capital One Venture card. Those are both really great, relatively straightforward options. They come at relatively low annual fees. The nice thing, though, is that if you are earning points in either one of those programs, they do have the ability later on for you to start building your prowess. So if you're like, look, I just want simple, go with one of those cards for now, but maybe 2-3 years down the road, you're like, all right, I'm pretty comfortable with this card now. I want to do more. They give you the option to do that because they do have, they partner with a number of airlines and hotels, and they allow you to convert your points that you earn or the miles that you earn on the Capital One Venture card directly to these airline and hotel loyalty programs. That's where you can really start to maximize those rewards. So I view those cards as great, you know, like starter cards that give you the runway or the ramp to really grow your experience in the future.
So somebody texts in and says, in general, is it beneficial to constantly be changing credit cards and chasing benefits, or is it generally better to stick with the same cards?
This, again, I will answer with my go-to, which is it depends. I've talked with a lot of our readers here at The Points Guy, a lot of my friends and family members who are like, I cannot manage more than one or two credit cards. Be honest with yourself. If you can't think through, I need to use this credit card for this purchase, and then this credit card gives me this benefit, and then this card gives me this perk, go simple. Go for a card that's going to give you a solid return, Capital One Venture card, Chase Sapphire Preferred, maybe a 2% cashback credit card. Changing credit cards a lot can be good if you're jumping on really good limited time bonus offers, or there are new perks that get added to a card that you're like, huh, that really fits my lifestyle. I want to go ahead and add that to your wallet. The big thing is that you don't want to be churning cards too quickly. If you're constantly opening cards and then closing them or opening them and downgrading them, a credit card issuer may say, you know what, this person is not really a good long-term value for us. We are going to go ahead and restrict the number of approvals that we're going to give them. Now, there are ways to play the game where you do have multiple cards. But again, you have to be honest with, do you have the time to really make sure that you understand your entire wallet and can really maximize more than one or more than a handful of cards at the same time?
Somebody texted in, I got an Amex Blue Cash Preferred this month. I guess that's a credit card. I get $120 a year for Disney Plus bundle I was already subscribed to. I get 6% back on other streaming services, so I just paid $91 for YouTube TV and got $5 back from that. And then they said it's cost $95 a year, but they waived the fee for the first year, a sign-up bonus of $250 when I spent $3,000 the first 6 months, which will be easy to do. My eyes glazed over halfway through that text, Nick, and I'm thinking I'm just going to charge it every 30 days, use the points to pay off the card. Thoughts?
Yeah. Again, this is where it's knowing who you are and what you want to focus on. A card like that can be really great, and you can really make the math work to justify that $95 annual fee. But you know what? There's also a no annual fee version of that card. It's called the Blue Cash Everyday. slightly lower earning rates, slightly different collection of perks. But that's another one where you're like, you know what? I don't even have to worry about paying the annual fee. And it's going to be a little bit easier to maximize that particular card. So again, just knowing how you want to focus and where you want to invest your energy. A lot of people say, forget it. It's simple. I just want simple. The big thing is do not say, forget it. I'm not going to play the game at all because you are missing out. Again, think of the baseline as a no annual fee credit card that gives you 2% back on everything you buy. If you're not playing that game and managing your credit responsibly, you're missing out on that reward. That's as simple as it gets.
So somebody texted in and said, to wrap it all up, is there any rule of thumb that would tell you by income level what's the best card for you to have, or it's all about what you spend the money on?
Yeah, really the income level doesn't really come into like which card is going to be best for you. Mm-hmm. The income level would just indicate how much you are able to spend on a given card in a given month to be able to pay it off in full. So really it's just about identifying the benefits that are really going to be most important to you and then picking the card that's going to match the spending habits as well as what you want to do. If you want to travel, a travel rewards card can be great. If you just want simple cash back to go towards your everyday expenses, then a cashback card is going to be a terrific fit.
I'm getting a lot of texts about the 3 and 4% that merchants charge because they're being charged that by the credit card company if it outweighs the benefits that you get. But that's all relative, right? I mean, it all depends on your situation.
Yeah, of course. So there are a number of merchants that are imposing these costs or otherwise positioning it as, you know, a cash discount. So again, that's where you need to decide, is that going to be worth incurring that extra fee? If you're using a card that's just a 1% cash back card or maybe 1 point for every dollar you spend at a particular store, then that probably isn't going to be worth it because the way you have to think about it is this 1 point that I'm going to earn be worth more than 3 cents when I go to use those rewards? In many cases, the answer is no.
The hour flies by too quickly. Nick Ewan, Senior Editorial Director at The Points Guy. It's thepointsguy.com, Nick.
Yep, thepointsguy.com. You can follow us on all the major social media platforms at The Points Guy.
Very valuable information. Thank you, Nick. We'll take a break, 9:54. Find out what Newell's got for us when we come back on WWL.